a quantum system. So we have some prototype quantum system. You know, it could be the NB system that we're talking about or some others. And what we said was that we would characterize the system by first trying to prepare some fiducial state. That, of course, that means that we have some map to the Hamiltonian, but we'll put all that in the background. Then we would measure the energy exchange of that state. So we'd measure the so-called T1, which is the lifetime of this state. And we typically measure that by creating the state the other state, and just looking at its lifetime as a function of time, making a measurement out here. And all the measurements are sigma z measurements in this case. We then said that we would measure the Rabi oscillation. So then we drive the system. So in this case, of course, what we saw as a function of time was a return back to the 0-0 state. And the Rabi oscillation now, the experiment, is that we're going to drive the system over for some time, but OK, over some angle, still make a measurement here. And we would see an oscillation. And of course, typically we do this by changing the time of that pulse. But it need not be. In some experiments, we simply change the amplitude of the drive field. So this, you know, this could be time as well. And we have a decay time here, a decay envelope. So this we call T Rabi. Then we measure the Ramsey fringe. Pi over 2 tau. Pi over 2. And so during this time, the system undergoes free precession, picks up a phase factor, and this last pulse maps that phase factor back into sigma z. And so if we look at the Ramsey, we'll see an oscillation like so. And this time, typically called T2 star, but it might be called T Ramsey. Now, of course, in the simplest picture of the block equations that we looked at, if there was no noise to talk about, then T1 equals T Rabi equals T Ramsey. But that's never the case. And so we looked at here. Remember in your block equation picture, I gave you a Krauss map that had two terms in the block in the Krauss sum. It had one term due to T1. And then it had an additional dephasing term. You saw the additional dephasing term led to T2 star being shorter. So we want to look at that. And the way we looked at that was to do the Ramsey experiment with a pi pulse in between. And what we saw was that there was an echo here. And an easy way of looking at that was that the operator during this time, e to the I omega noise over 2, sigma z tau over 2. And this time, put a prime there this time. That we could take this operator and move it into an interaction frame based upon this pulse here. We could use this excitation to define an interaction frame. And that the action of this interaction frame would be to change the sign. And I changed it beforehand. Don't do that. Would be to change the sign of this. And then, of course, if omega n and omega n prime were the same, then the overall noise, the overall dynamics would go to zero. So what we saw here is that we could define an interaction frame. Let's just be a little bit more careful about that. So now this interaction frame, remember we were looking at the rotating wave approximation. What did we do? We defined a unitary that was going to move with the dynamics we wanted to remove from the picture. Okay? And in the case of the rotating wave approximation, it was very simple. It was a time-independent rotation, right? We were always rotating with the same frequency about the same axis. Now, when you looked at the adiabatic sweep, you saw a different thing. What we saw there was, again, that we had a time-independent rotation. What's about an angle that we changed over time? Right, so the interaction frame actually became time independent there. And when you look at, I don't know if it's actually in the homework, when we looked at the problem last class, which is either in this homework or will be in the next homework, of looking at the dephasing in the quantum Zeno effect, you'll see the same thing, that we'll have a Krauss map that's going to rotate in time, and that orientation will define an interaction frame. But now an interaction frame whose axis changes in time. Here, we have an interaction frame whose axis changes in time, but changes abruptly in time. And so it's the so-called toggling frame. And toggling because we're going to be in one frame here, and then abruptly we move to another frame. And it's a little bit nicer if I redraw that pulse sequence for you, like this. So now then, let's put in some phases. Let's say this is y, that we'll put that along y, I'll put this along minus y. So these two, right, are going to cancel out. And then I'm going to put this along minus y as well, because I want to go back to making a plus sigma z measurement, right? And then I say, oh yes, here I have some interaction where the affected Hamiltonian is equal to omega n sigma z. And here I have an affected Hamiltonian, which is equal to omega n sigma z. We'll put a prime there. And then I take this piece here and say, oh yeah, now I have a Hamiltonian in the toggling frame, okay, which is equal to minus omega n prime sigma z, right? And then we say, ah, well, what's the average of this Hamiltonian over that cycle? Remember that when we looked at going into the rotating wave, what we said was first we would go into the interaction frame, and then we're going to take the time-independent piece of the Hamiltonian in the interaction frame, right? And that would be the rotating wave approximation, right? That was the approximation piece of the rotating wave approximation. We keep the time-independent piece. Okay, so that's easy. I can say I will enjoy when we have this bigger room in the next year. And we can take h bar, the average of these. And notice, in this particular case, I mean, light is great. Always commutes with each other, right? So the average is just a bloody average. So there's no approximation here that says, hey, the average Hamiltonian, let's put the times in, tau over 2. So it's 1 over tau over 2 of this term minus this term because of that negative sign. Yeah. And now, of course, if omega n is equal to omega n prime, then the average Hamiltonian is equal to 0. And you know, life is great. It says nothing happens. There's no decay here. Yeah, Tiber.
So the third pulse, we have one bit, one, The first bit is like pi, and the second bit is pi
over
2, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All of the minus y axis.
All of that minus y axis.
So we're rewriting the pi by 2 like that.
Yeah, and so I say, oh, well, okay. So how do we actually apply this? Thanks for the question. We apply this as a pi over 2 pulse about the y-axis. Yeah? Yes, please.
What is the right space? There's lambda tau lambda 2.
Average.
So this is 1 over tau? Right? Because I'm going to take the average over time, so we have that much time. Right? If I define a Hamiltonian, I want to keep the time dependence out of it. Okay. Now, this isn't enough for us. If we look at this piece, what does it tell us? It tells us that the Hahn echo let me say a word. Why the word echo here? The word echo, because we get back whatever state we had here, we get back that state here. Right, so the Hahn echo is actually referring to these two states. And, of course, you see that the effective propagator over this time is the identity operator, right? So if I looked in between, you know, if I looked at what happens here and here and here and here and here, well, then I would see the Ramsey fringe experiment, right? And so I'd see the signal decay. And so if I had looked at the magnetization, I would see something like this, and then I would see its mirror image over here. And we'd say, oh, yes, we get back our signal. Now, of course, we absolutely have to lose by T1 during that time, right? Yeah, so no way of avoiding that. But we don't lose by T2 star. Yeah, please.
The toggling frame
is a bookkeeping that allows us to keep track of the dynamics, just like in the interaction frame, that we have some big Hamiltonian interaction frame that we don't really care about. And so I want to throw it away to do a simple calculation. Here, I don't really care about the dynamics of this. Now, I mean, of course, I could have integrated this whole thing, right? In this case, it's pretty easy. Okay, I'll show you examples where it's not. And I would get exactly the same result. Yep. But by going to a toggling frame, I don't have to integrate it. All I have to do is define an effective Hamiltonian. And then I end up with a time-independent Hamiltonian, which, of course, is trivial to integrate over.
So in the toggling frame, you just kind of flip over the...
Well, in this particular one here, I chose this toggling frame because that's what the experiment defines, right? That the experiment is to put this pi pulse here. Okay, and that leads me to define this particular toggling representation that does flip over the plane of the spin evolution. Let me save your question. At the end of the class, I'll go over two more examples. If it's not obvious, then we go over it again, okay? Other questions? Yes, please.
The idea of these two, of this pi over 2 and pi over 2.
Okay. Remember that we have an internal Hamiltonian that is going to be some big frequency about sigma z. So you know, let's say that we're looking at superconductors or we're looking at electrons. This term is of order 3 gigahertz. You know, it's big. Or at least it's big if you're not doing optics. And then we ask, well, what sort of noise is going to survive this interaction, right? So if I have this Hamiltonian, this is the Hamiltonian that's defining the dynamic. This is the most important piece of the Hamiltonian. And of course, what does it tell us? It tells us that there's two energy levels in this spin 1/2 system. And they're separated by omega naught. Life is easy. And it says that if I have a coherence in this system, right? So if I put the state psi into an equal superposition state, 0 plus 1, then that's going to pick up a phase shift, right? So as I apply this term, it's going to pick up, as a function of time under this Hamiltonian, it's going to pick up a phase that is e to the I omega naught t over 2, right? So it's going to pick up a phase, and it's going to be as though the coherence was rotating in the transverse plane. And so then we say, well, what noise can survive that? If I have a noise that's perpendicular to this, right, this is now just a classical picture. Just take it as a classical picture. We have our coherence on the Bloch sphere. Remember that the Bloch sphere is a classical picture, but it's isomorphic to SU2. By looking at a classical picture, I've not thrown away any physics. There's a perfect isomorphism here. Okay, so this is rotating around at omega naught. And then I put a little noise term here. I say, okay, let me add a noise. And a noise, for a spin 1/2 particle, the only motion we have is a torque, right? That's all that happens in a spin 1/2 system. So we have a noise that says I have a torque about that axis. And what do I mean by small? I mean that the energy of it, omega n, is much, much less than omega naught. Yeah? So what does it do as to the trajectory of this as the spin's rotating around? Well, you've got your torque here. So it says, well, when the spin is on this side, it's going to be pushing it down a little bit. And when it's on this side, it's going to be pushing it up a little bit. And if I average over a cycle, it doesn't do a bloody thing. Right? The spin keeps coming back exactly where it was. Right? And this is a common thing called second averaging. That says if I have a noise term that's perpendicular to a strong interaction, the influence of that noise is small. And now you've heard that before. Right? What does it say? It says that if I have a perturbation, and the perturbation is orthogonal, then it doesn't shift the eigenvectors. All it does, at most, is to shift the energies in second order. And what's the second order? It says that, hey, this is tilted just a little bit from that axis. And that tilt is the arctan of those two frequencies. Right? So here we say, look, if I want to have a noise that influences the dynamics, then the only place that a DC noise can influence the dynamics is if it's along Z. So if I have this Hamiltonian, and I'm adding a noise, and if I want that noise to have an effect on the state, then I have two choices. One, the noise must be along Z. Okay? Well, that's easy, right? If the noise is along Z, right, commutes with this, then we just add it in there. Okay, and it changes the precession frequency. No averaging occurs at all. We see that directly. And what's the other one? Anyone picture the other noise that will survive? If I have a noise that's in the xy plane, it has to move with the spins. Right? So I can, the other solution is to have a noise in the xy plane at a frequency of omega naught. Okay, so that if I had the spin sitting here and I had a small noise over here and it rotated in exactly in phase with that, well then of course it can influence the dynamics. And you saw that in the rotating wave approximation, right? That if I went into a rotating frame, then with this term, then the spins would be static, the noise would be static, and it wouldn't surprise you that the noise would have an influence. Yeah?
That means resonance, right?
Absolutely. The noise would be on resonance. Yeah? So, so this is why I choose this particular noise model, because it's the only one that'll survive. Did I answer your question? Okay. Or at least you're going to give up. All right. So now I want to look at noise in more detail. So remember that if we looked at the Hein echo, we said, oh yeah, we get to an echo here, provided these two frequencies are the same over the time scale of the echo. And we keep stretching out the echo and looking at longer and longer time scales. But it's a little bit of a difficult experiment to analyze in terms of the properties of the noise. Because what I extract from the Hein echo is a decay function. So I extract one time, and that one time is going to report on what happens for the short time and for the long time. So I lose information. And so what Carr and Purcell said is to do the experiment this way. Instead of giving one pi pulse, give a whole string of pi pulses. And so now we've set a time by the frequency with which we give out, we apply these pi pulses. Yes?
I have absolutely no idea what it means to apply a pi pulse. So, in language of mathematics, what are you doing?
Yeah?
Yeah.
Perfect.
You probably in light, right? Signal light, usually?
It doesn't make any difference. Yeah.
And then the little lower strip, like Y, X, or Z, means which signal we are using.
Exactly right. Okay. Thanks. Good. Okay, so now then we look at what happens here. And I want to split the experiment into blocks. And let's look at this block that is has a length tau. Okay. The first thing you see about this block that has length tau is that if I look only at the RF, then the overall propagator is the identity. So it's a nice thing to apply over and over again, because you know we can do the keep doing the identity as much as we would like. Yeah.
You can choose factory whatever you like, right? It's not determined
by the noise. Say it again.
You choose
factory. I choose, that's right. And it will report on a particular value of the noise. Yeah. Yeah. So here we've got this piece, and the way you want to think about this is we're going to have n cycles of this time. And what will we see? Well, just like the Hahn echo over there, right? There would be an echo at this point. So there's our initial T2 star decay. Here's an echo. There would be an echo here, etc. And it keeps going on. There'd be this whole slew of echoes. And we're going to ignore these echoes because I really like this condition that the propagator is equal to 1. Okay, if the propagator is equal to 1, I can analyze all of these cycles back to back, and I know that everything commutes with each other, and if I just look at the average dynamics, I'll get everything. I don't have to worry about any non-commutivity in the whole process. Now, I need a model for how this noise is going to change, right? I need some model to say how that is going to change. And so I'm going to do a simple picture. We'll take omega n, and we'll just say, as a function of some variable, I'll call it z, but it doesn't matter whether it's time, space, experiment number, phase of the moon. Phase of the moon is a good one for neutrons. We can see the phase of the moon in our neutron interferometry experiment. Here, it's just some parameter that's going to allow us to index a classical probability distribution. Okay? And so now then I say, oh yes, I have this distribution of omega n as a function of z, and I can, you know, say that I have a probability distribution for this. Now, the reason I've introduced this parameter is I want to introduce a simple diffusive motion. So we'll look at p of z, z plus delta z as a function, at a time. And we'll just take it to be a Gaussian distribution. So right, just a Gaussian distribution. And sigma, of course, is the width of the Gaussian, and it's going to be the square root of 2dt, where d is some effective diffusion coefficient written in this parameter space. Okay? So let's see what this says to us. It says, hey, at some moment in time, we look and we find that omega naught is here. Okay? Doesn't matter where. We just look and we find it. Okay? And then we wait for some time. And we get a mapping of z to some new probability function. And then I say, ah, well, what is omega naught? Well, omega naught now is spread out over those values. Okay? And as I wait longer and longer, this spreads as the square root of time. So it has nice properties that we would like for a random process. And it also has the lovely property that it's static. So that stationary, sorry. So that So this is equal to just a probability in terms of delta z, right? So that z does not appear in the probability displacement. Yeah. So that's very nice. It says that every position I look at, I'm going to see exactly the same thing. Okay. So this motion shows up as a kernel. Yeah? All right. Now then, I'm over here, and we're going to apply those ideas to this sequence. Okay? And so it says first, I have a range of noise that are the possible values of the noise in my system. Okay? And as the system evolves, here, we take the system from its initial state, create a coherent superposition, allow it to evolve. As it evolves, it's going to pick up information about what the noise value is, and it's going to do that as a function of time, right? It's going to get a phase angle that is omega n sub t, right? And the way I want to write this, let me see if I can get it correct for a change. Yeah, that's okay. The way I'm going to look at it is I'm going to look at it as a function of this particular variable. Okay, and I need to define a quantity that is d omega n dz. Right, because I'm going to integrate over here because that's defining my probability distribution. Yeah? All right. So here I'm going to have the integral of e to the I omega n sub z times t, and I can put the integral here, dz. Yeah? And now I can say, well, what does this look like as a function of z? If I plotted out this phase as a function of z, then what I would find is a nice sinusoidal behavior, right? Because all I'm doing is multiplying a frequency times time. Yeah, so I get the nice sinusoidal behavior. And, of course, since it's a function of z, I can define a wave number for this, and k we'll just define it that way, 2 pi over k. Okay? So now then I have a term that goes as e to the I kz. Okay? So if I plotted here k as a function of time, what would I find? Well, I would find that k increases as a function of time over that interval. And just like we saw over here with the Hahn echo, when we apply a pi pulse, we change the sign of k. Remember that what we happened here? We applied a pi pulse, and we had this xy plane, and we flipped the plane over. When you flip the plane over, we change the sign of k. K is just a sign in the transverse plane. So when I apply a pi pulse, I go from k naught to minus k naught. Okay? And the dynamics occur in exactly the same way over and over and over again. Okay. Now, let me be a little bit careful here, right? What we're saying is this piece here is defining our interaction frame, right? So this piece is saying, hey, I've taken and I've rotated the interaction frame by 180 degrees. Yeah? So we have interaction frame A, B, A, B. And the noise, we said, was along the z-axis. So if I looked at H tilde, well, in this frame, it's omega in sigma z. Here it's minus omega in sigma z. Here it's omega in sigma z, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah? So we keep toggling back and forth between those two interaction frames. Okay, so far there's nothing interesting here because I haven't put in this piece. I haven't put in the chance that the spins can move. All we've mapped out is what happens along this line. Okay? So now we allow the spins to move. And you know how they're going to move. We've said that the probability that the spins are displaced is independent of their location. It comes in as this kernel. So if I want to know how they move, how the spins move, I simply need to look at the convolution of that. So we say, oh, well, okay, I know what happens initially. I have this term e to the I kz. All right? That's what happens at some moment. I'm going to call it k0 because I want to keep the general reciprocal space variable here. And then we say, oh, well, look, we allow this motion, p of delta zt. Right? We allow the system to evolve, to move, to get blurred out along the z-axis. And so this is equal to e to the I k naught z convolved with this Gaussian. And now, to calculate this, it's pretty simple, but the easiest way is just to take it to reciprocal space, right? So have all of you heard of the Wiener-Kitchen theorem, convolution theorem? 5-2 functions, f of t convolved with g of t. This is equal to the Fourier transform of f of omega times g of omega, where f or g of omega is equal to the integral e to the I omega t f of t dt. Yeah, should be familiar to everyone. Life is good. I take the Fourier transform of e to the I kz. You'll tell me with enthusiasm that this is just a delta function at k equals k0. And we're going to multiply it because it's times. And the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. And I've nicely normalized it here. So remember that the first point of a function, the zero frequency point, or the zero k point in this case, is the integrated intensity. And the integrated intensity of a normalized Gaussian better be 1. So we're using it as a probability. So the Fourier transform of this is e to the minus k squared sigma squared over 2. Yep. So that's all nice. And if I multiply a delta function by some other function, I'm just going to sample it at the value defined by the delta function. So this thing is equal to e to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2. And now we've defined sigma already. So if I combine these two, we have e to the minus k naught squared dt. Yeah? So it says, how do we lose this grating that we've created in space? Right? By evolving under this noise, each orientation, each location in Z picks up a different phase factor. Okay? And if we look at some instant in time, we see this grating. And how do we lose that grating? Well, we lose that grating by every location being convolved with the Gaussian. But since every location is convolved with the Gaussian, the only thing that can happen is we attenuate the grating. So pretend I can draw a cosine. And this difference is given by that rate. And so the effective loss of information, right, here, the rate of information loss is T2 is equal to 1 over k naught squared d. Right? So otherwise, it looks exactly like a Lorentzian function, right? With just the loss. Okay, I know it's a lot of things. I'm going to tell you one more piece, and then we're going to go back to the physics. And we'll try to pull it all together. Now, what did we calculate here? What we calculated here was to say, if I have a time-independent grating, okay? If I have a time-independent grating, and I allow the noise to change here, then I get an effective attenuation. But the grating isn't time-independent, right? As the noise is changing, through this diffusive process, the spins or the qubits are evolving. They're sensing the noise, right? And so you have to allow me to do one more thing. Just do it quickly over here to say that k is a function of time. So it's k dt times t, right? We defined it up here. And this is equal to a constant times d omega n dz. Okay? So this is all okay. So then we say, well, okay, what do we need to do? We need to integrate k of t times d dt. Right. I'm just going to integrate this expression to look at what happens over time. But of course, k of t looks like t squared. K of t looks like t squared. And so the answer is that if we have the gradient changing and the noise varying, we get the term that looks like e to the minus k naught squared dt over 3. Pick up this extra factor of 3. Not so important, but it's easy to see where it comes from. Okay. So, we pick up a dependence here that says that as I look out in time, look at the intensity of this echo here. It falls off as e to the minus k naught squared dt over 3. K naught squared is equal to e to the minus dk dt tau squared t over 3. So we see that now we've been able to introduce tau into this picture of the dynamics. Okay, so now tau actually has a meaning. It says that the sampling of this change in noise depends upon the frequency with which we look. And of course, it depends upon the diffusive process. The whole thing is still Lorentzian. You'll find some really horrible papers. This is Lorentzian. That say that the decay goes as t cubed. The decay does not go as t cubed. It goes as time. There is a tau squared dependence on it, but that's not evolving in time. Tau squared is constant. Okay. Let me take a step back from all this math, and let's ask, what did we do? We said that if we have some variation in noise, let me lose all this over here. If I have some variation in the noise, I'm going to use my qubit to figure out what that noise is. It takes some time. So I say that I have a qubit. And we create a coherence. We're going to use the phase of this coherence to tell us about the noise. Okay? So now then I could say, well, fine. I take and have omega n equals 0. And I plot, let's plot sigma x. Okay? So the experiment is, we apply a pi over 2 pulse, and we just wait for some time t, and we look here at sigma x, and this axis is t. Well, if omega naught is equal to 0, and if I put this pulse about the y-axis, then it's just going to be flat, right? If omega naught has some value greater than 0, if I look at time, I'm going to see a cosine function. And if I want to say, hey, when can I tell that there was a noise? Well, I have to wait for a time of order 1 over omega sub n. Right? If I look too soon, then it looks like there's no noise. Okay? And of course, we have many possibilities for noise. We just make it bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, if I have all of these noise, regardless of what they are, and I apply a pi pulse here, and I wait for the same amount of time, then they're all going to go back to the t equals 0 position, right? So if there's no motion in noise, then we get this echo. And this intensity and that intensity are only different by T1. There's no information there at all. In fact, there's not even information at that point about the strength of the noise, right? The only information about the strength of the noise is this particular decay, right? This decay tells us the strength of the noise. We get the Hahn echo. If we see that the intensities are the same, then all we know about that is that the noise didn't change over those two times. Okay? And then we say, well, okay, that's a drag. But now we have a model that allows the noise to change. It's going to be sensitive to the noise changing. When is it sensitive? It's sensitive when the distribution of when the width of the change in frequency is on the order of this cosine. But remember what this cosine is. This is a cosine versus z, not time. So here I've said we have all of these cosines going on, and these frequencies are proportional to z. Let's take a slice right here. If I take a slice right here at some value, then I'll say, oh yes, I have, it's hard to see here, but I've created a grating in the phase. If I plotted, that's too messy now. Let me just do it over here. Let me just plot as a function of the z-axis, which is also the strength of omega n, at some time, the expectation value for sigma x. So if I choose that time to be 0, no sensitivity. If I choose that time to be longer than 0, then we get this grating. And if I choose the time to be short, the shorter I make it, the finer that grating becomes. As that grating becomes finer, become more and more and more sensitive to the noise. And the nice thing about the Karp-Russell sequence is I can choose exactly how sensitive I am. So this k value here is the periodicity of this grating. So this thing is 2 pi over k. So what would happen here if I packed these pi pulses closer and closer together? So if I take, instead of having these particular pi pulses, if I put in pi pulses, I have to get this right. It would look like that. If I put in pi pulses at half the spacing, then of course, at this point, up to there it looks the same. At this point, it gets inverted. And we get a smaller dependence on the fluctuations of the noise. In other words, the time shorter, right, we're going to look at the faster fluctuating noise. And we can keep squeezing this in, or we're making it longer. And at the end of the day, what we see is if I plot the frequency of the noise versus T2, it's nicest to plot the inverse of T2. We'll see a decay that looks like this, where T2 is I better get this right. Yeah, this is fine. This is an Karp-Russell sequence. So T2 is shortest when tau times omega n is about equal to 1. When the noise has zero frequency components, when the noise is DC, the Karp-Russell sequence removes it completely. When the noise is exactly the periodicity of the Karp-Russell sequence, we're in trouble, right? Because then I can say, oh, well, I'll have a cosine of the noise here. And you can see that the Karp-Russell sequence will make all the contributions positive if we're in the right phase, so that we get a real short T2. And as we increase the frequency of the noise beyond that, well, if I increase the frequency really, really fast, I'll do it up here. I have a pi over 2 pulse, and then I have a pi pulse and another pi pulse. But let's just look at this point. I have the noise that's oscillating really, really fast. And here, of course, since we're plotting out the spectral density of this, we're saying, we're looking at a cosine function, right? We're saying, hey, the noise has one frequency. If I plot out this cosine function, and then I'm going to integrate over it to come up with the overall phase evolution, then, of course, if I have many, many oscillations, they effectively integrate to 0. Okay. And so as the frequency increases, the T2 becomes longer again. Okay? As it, so it's long over here, okay, and then it's short at this resonance point, and then it's long over here. So using the Karpfer-Cell sequence, by changing this time, tau, we can change the sensitivity of the T2 to the various frequencies in the noise. And we can invert that to map out the noise power as a function of frequency. So the benefit of the Karpfer-Cell sequence is twofold. One, if you're suppressing noise, it says, oh, hey, I can keep the signal alive for a very long time, and yet I can remove frequencies where I can remove noise where the noise is still fluctuating. If the noise is fluctuating, I can still remove it. Exactly how efficiently? Exactly this efficiently. Okay? By having the pi pulses be fast compared to the fluctuations of the noise. Okay? And if so if I'm just trying to run the sequence to keep a quantum state, then I run it fast. And although this was defined in the 60s, in the 90s, the quantum information people thought it needed a new name. And so they called it dynamical decoupling. By giving it a new name, they could publish the same results all over again. The old name was decoupling. Nothing changed about the theory, nothing changed about the experiment. So just the title changed. And so he says, oh yeah, we can keep it around. But more importantly for us, what it allows us to do is to know, is to systematically vary tau and map out the noise power as a function of frequency. And so we can tell what this probability distribution should look like. Okay? And that's what we're after there. Okay, I meant to give you one more example, and I didn't mean to have quite as complicated version of this discussion as we ended up having. So what's the important pieces here? The important pieces are first, that we can define an interaction frame that is based upon just our action to the system. In this case, we define the interaction frame just based upon the driving field, the pulses that we apply to the system. And in doing that, we can modulate both the coherent dynamics, that's easy to see, that's the DC part of the noise, the coherent dynamics, and we can modulate the noise. So even though there's a random event, we can use our ability to create a time-dependent interaction frame to partially or completely suppress noise which is fluctuating in time. And it's not required that if we're looking to suppress noise for a long time, capital T, that our modulation has a frequency of 1 over capital T, that we have a freedom. We can make the modulation frequencies be much shorter than that. In addition, in order to make it work nicely, we would like to arrange the modulation so that we can apply it over and over and over and over again, and yet still only look at it as an average of the dynamics. And for that to be the case, we arrange for these cycles to have, for the independent elements of the cycles, to have overall propagators of the identity, so that we can concatenate these things and know what the long-term dynamics are by only looking at the dynamics over one cycle, right? So if I look at the dynamics over one cycle, then I can just take that cycle to the power n, and I know what happens over n cycles. And so it's a very powerful way of looking at this, because I don't have to integrate over everything that could happen in the sequence. I only, in fact, have to calculate an effective Hamiltonian and look at it over one short time block. Okay, so tomorrow what we'll do is take this and we'll go ahead and look at how it applies to suppressing an environment for a qubit. So if I have a qubit, then of course it's going to see an environment. That environment is going to look like this noise. I'd like to be able to suppress that noise as well. All right? Okay. Not completely happy with this lecture. So come and see me with questions, okay? And of course, as always, if you want to come by on Wednesday to have a beer and talk about this at IQC, please do that too. Okay? Thanks.